Yeah, me too.
Wow. Here we go. You know, it's really funny. I was watching a bunch of interviews with Melissa Bernstein and some other people, including Amazon's Fishbowl and whatever. And they did my favorite thing where they said, today we have a very special guest, which is to say that every time they've ever started the show, they're like, today we had a completely normal guest. Sure, they weren't that important. I mean, whatever. But today.
Or the corollary is true that every guest is special. And I don't think that could be Ben.
Exactly. So we, I don't still know how Carrie got this put together, but we have a chance to talk to Melissa Bernstein, who wrote the book Lifelines and has an incredible story. You may or may not know her from a little red and white logo all over a whole ton of toys, Melissa and Doug, but there's so much more to cover. Carrie, you landed this. How'd you even do this?
I asked nicely because I'm very well. So the book, the full title of Melissa's book is Lifelines, an inspirational journey from profound darkness to radiant light. So if all you knew was that Melissa co-founded a famous toy company, you would not have any idea of, you know, her personal journey and how she overcame some of the challenges that the rest of us face, you know, in trying to accomplish things in our lives like anxiety, depression, despair. I thought that was a story that we need to help other people find their way to success.
I always let people know that I have a minor case of major clinical depression. But wait till you hear Melissa's, the official prognosis of her statement. It's pretty harsh. So we got to dig in. We have some questions to ask.
Welcome to the Backpack Show with your host, Chris Brogan and Carrie Gargone. Boom shakalaka.
So it's a big one today.
Yes, because I think a lot of people don't. I would love to normalize the conversation around these things, which is something you've worked on for years. I think it's really important.
I'm just really waiting for the day that people talk about depression the way they talk about allergies and don't make such a big stink about it. But we'll see how it gets there. Hey, let me do a couple ad reads and then we'll get into this. So want to make a show just like this one? We're sponsored by StreamYard. cbrogan.me/StreamYard. You can make
Ducks
a show.
Do not sound like that.
Ducks say wah, wah. And when they're really crazy because they're hoping you feed them, they go wah, 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 wah.
So everything you see, all the cool features, all the comments we show, the banners we show, guests joining us, all made possible by StreamYard. cbrogan.me/StreamYard. Make your own show.
That one. Hey, like what we talk about, but you don't like our faces? Get our audio podcast. You can get it anywhere that you can get an audio podcast. It's hosted by the nice people at Castos.com. They put the P's back in podcasting. Castos.com.
Something else. Hi, Jane. Jane says, boom, shakalaka.
That is the voice of Tim Kitzrow from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz. Now we'll get our own boom shakalaka kind of person in here, Melissa Bernstein. So we're going to learn about lifelines. Melissa, hi.
Hi. Hi, Carrie and Chris.
I'm not the only one who like waves and blows kisses and does silly things on camera.
I always do. And I also do this a lot. That's like my thank you when I can't speak.
Very expressive as well. So this is fun for me.
So we talked about the book and or the website and or the experience that has been put together around Lifelines. Wow. Where it talks all about, you know, by the way, what a gorgeous site. I was doing this and wiggling that leaf around a lot over and over again, though, like got a little weird. But this whole thing is about, you know, how do we get to talk about how we're feeling? How do we get to understand how we have to work through it and move through it and all that? Now, people write books sometimes and fancy people like yourselves who earned over $1 billion in revenue over time sometimes write books as well, usually worse books. But this is a really good one and it means a whole heck of a lot. You've done a lot of things to put this here. What made you decide this is probably how I'm going to use my time and this is how I'm going to move the story forward?
Wow, that's a great question. And you asked about my dogs. They're here, so you're going to hear them. Our furry friends are my lifelines. I wish you could see them. They're so cute. And they're named after Melissa and Doug customers. There's Amazon Prime Bernstein and TJ Maxwell Bernstein. So, but we call Amazon Prime Maisie. So she's got a nickname.
So is the puppy going to be Etsy? Like, how's
I don't, that's a great, we haven't used Etsy yet. So, but maybe. So that's a great question. And I think, you know, this story probably never would have come out if not for a few dots connecting that made it clear that if I didn't heed the cry of my own soul to be authentically seen, I would never rest in peace. And literally, I felt like impelled to finally move from inauthentic being to authentic being. And it was like, it took a lifetime to get there, but I'm finally here. And now I am vibing my authentic self. It doesn't mean every day is blissful, because I think people think authenticity equals happiness every day. It doesn't, not for someone like me, but it does mean I'm not carrying around the weight of hiding who I am. And that alone is a huge relief.
I was just thinking, you know, maybe not happiness every day, but at least like some part of every day, find something to be happy about, which can be it kind of and by itself an accomplishment, especially in a year like we had last year, you know, where it feels like all the news is bad and everything's already depressing.
I think it's also, for me, it was about accepting everything as part of who I am. Because when you're someone who is born with what I call, and what one of my favorite philosophers called, overexcitabilities, it's a heightened arousal of your central nervous system, which makes living really challenging in a conventional world, because I didn't feel accepted for who I was, which is a really introverted creative misfit. And knowing that I'd never be accepted for that, I basically hid everything I was and tried to be everything I wasn't in adopting this facade. So I disassociated from who I was. So I think once I finally accepted it, it didn't mean every day was blissful, but it did mean I was like comfortable finally with, you know, I'm having a low day, but this is who I am.
I mentioned in the intro that I always say I get to suffer a minor case of major clinical depression, but your title is something more intense. It was like, was it profound existential depression and anxiety? Is that, did I name it?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that it's a big one. And I didn't even know what the word existential meant until I was close to like in my 40s. And I read the dictionary for fun. So I'm a word person and I didn't even know what that meant. And the crazy thing about existential depression is it's not even listed in the diagnostic and statistical manual for mental disorders. It's not considered really like a pathological condition. It's a philosophical condition that's based on a meaning crisis. So I was born with a crisis of meaning. I didn't understand why I was here, what the meaning of life was, if we were ultimately like going to die. And I didn't understand what I was supposed to do during my brief time here. And I know it sounds crazy, and some can go through a temporary, you know, meaning crisis, like during COVID. I think a lot of people understood what it means to have an existential crisis, but mine was just from the very beginning. And because no one gives you those answers and you can't even verbalize the questions, because I couldn't get those answers to those questions that plagued me every single moment of every single day, I lived in this profound sense of despair that everything I did was futile and there was sort of no meaning to existence, which, you know, can bring you to a really low place.
Wow. And you made toys. It's not like you were in like finance or something. Like, you brought joy to children. Most people would think that
I think toys was the first time that my despair started to shift a little bit, because before that, you know, I did create from the time I can remember. I wrote music, I wrote verses, I crafted, like I was creative. But for the most part, I created really dark things from the darkness that filled me up. And I thought I didn't have a choice. I thought I was like a victim of just darkness and despair and all that it would birth was more darkness. So I never showed anybody what I made. For the first 20 years of my life, I created incessantly, but I hid it away in the shadows and didn't let anyone ever see it. It was like a secret. And because of that, it never gave me meaning. You know, I never found that meaning I was seeking. But when, sort of by accident, Doug and I decided to focus on toys and children and having never designed products, and I realized that I could actually take that very same darkness that created all those dark songs and verses and channeled that same darkness into toys that could have the potential to spark imagination and light up a child. That was like the first air that I was able to breathe that was kind of like fresh air.
One of the challenges that people don't understand about depression of any flavor is just that it has really very little to do with your reasons to be happy. And a lot of people who don't or haven't suffered depression say, well, what would you have had to be sad about? Things were going great. You had a great business, which makes you feel like, well, I don't know. I really can't answer that question. Just know I'm feeling that way. How have you, since you've outed yourself a bit about this and through the book and all that, how have you been guiding people who are dealing with relatives and family members and friends who deal with depression? What's kind of some of the advice in and around the book, but just even when you're sitting after a speech you've given, what do you say to them in that line when they say, oh, now I think I know what my wife's feeling?
Yeah. So I think I can relate on so many levels. You know, I think for a long time, I didn't feel that I deserved to be depressed in any way. And I think so many come to me who say, like, I don't deserve this. I have a good life. Everything is actually good in my life. And I say to them, like, it has nothing to do with the external that's going on in your life. Like, I have everything I could have ever wanted in my entire life. I have a beautiful partner, Doug, my husband, who I met when I was 19. And we, you know, started this business together, which is still growing after 33 years. I have 6 children. I've like every material thing I could ever want. But still, like, external achievements and validation don't fill that inner void if you haven't learned to love yourself. So I think it doesn't really matter what you've achieved. It has no bearing on your chemical and biological makeup. So I want, you know, I first tell people that you deserve whatever you're feeling to feel it and to be accepted for feeling it. And nobody chooses or wants to be depressed. Like, all I ever prayed for was that I wouldn't be down, I wouldn't be depressed, and I wouldn't feel that life is futile. So I think, you know, the fact that I feel that way, I have to own it because it's who I am, and so does everyone else. So I tell them, don't be ashamed for how you feel. The first step to accepting who you are is accepting exactly how you're feeling. And I think my advice to everyone is we have to stop, you know, look at where we are in our lives. If we've reached that point when we can't take it anymore, when the despair has gotten too great. And finally, at some point, we have to make a choice whether we want to go inward and do the work. And I think it is work. You know, life is diving inward, taking that journey, which for me took over 4 years, and finally kind of unearthing who we are at our core and really accepting the fact that we are everything. You know, I realize there's a spectrum, this circular spectrum of emotion. And I am from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. And it's all part of me. And until I was able to accept every single bit of it, the darkness and the light as part of me, like, I wasn't able to come out of the abyss into authenticity.
While you're undertaking all this really heavy emotional work, you're still running a business and people still have expectations for you. How did you manage to undertake it? Like, if you were having a really, if you had a breakthrough day, but you were feeling really exhausted and down, how do you manage to still get things done that need to get done? Can you delegate? Like, what advice do you have for people who are running a business, but also need to face that kind of work?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, my coping mechanism throughout my life was very conducive to running a business. because I anchored to performance and overachievement as my method of validation, because I wasn't accepted for who I was, which was, again, this creative person that kind of muttered to herself and wrote music in her head and did some odd things. I needed validation for something, and that became achievement and performance. So I had to continually achieve for validation and to drown out that mortality drumbeat in my head. So no matter what, I kept achieving. And I think the more despondent I felt, the more I felt the need to engage in that futile race toward, accomplishing more and having more children and creating more toys. It was all part of the same need to leave a legacy. So for me, it was effective. It was a chip on my shoulder that pushed me and drove me to be able to really manage this company while having six children. For those that have the other side of it, because it's two sides of the same coin, right? I overachieved and I pushed myself until I cracked ultimately from exhaustion. The other side of it is paralysis and not being able to do anything and kind of being immobilized. I think for those folks, it's more acute. And for them, they would need sort of intervention of some sort to, I think, get them to be able to start to function and make those baby steps forward. You know, I was never really in bed and couldn't get out. Mine was masking it with overachievement and running in a futile race.
I was reading that about your list of your compulsions are things like I exercised a lot and I like designed even more toys. And I was just like, grr, because my depression was like, you know what would be great right now? Bed would be great right now. And then I would sleep for 3 days and I'd go, you know what else would be great? More bed. I want to take it out of that. And I want to get to, you didn't stop at a book because you're. And you said, I think I'm going to make this website. I think I'm going to do more than a website. I think I'm going to make this thing where we're going to give you a backpack. We're going to make you go on a hike. You want to talk to us a little bit through the process of what people are going to do if they get involved in the Lifeline situation to kind of bring their life to where they want it to be?
Oh my gosh, I would love to. Yeah, I think, Doug and I realized that this was how we really wanted to spend the rest of our days, because although we've loved more than anything making toys, and we're still involved, in making the toys. But truly, if we could convince someone to hang on another day, that their life is worth living and they're not alone, there would be no greater gift. So this was how I really wanted to spend my life, really communing with people who've always felt outside the fray, always felt they don't belong, always felt that something is wrong with them and they're dropped here from another planet, which was how I always felt. And I didn't want people to feel that way. So we wanted to create an entire ecosystem that made people not feel so alone, that engaged them in real, authentic conversation, talking about things that nobody talks about, talking about a lot of the societal myths that force us to be what we're not and force us to feel inadequate when we don't achieve the pursuit of happiness, or we don't look a certain way, or we don't go to an elite college. Like, society puts all this stuff on us, these goals, and no one achieves them. And then we all feel like we're losers and feel inadequate. And when I realized that that was everybody, from Olympic athletes to models to company founders, we all felt inadequate, I realized we have so much work to do societally. So we're talking about a lot of these things. We have a journey on our ecosystem as the centerpiece, which is so funny because we both talk about backpacks and we both have these metaphorical backpacks. And ours really is this backpack you strap on to take this journey inward and really unshroud yourself of all the pretensions you've, sort of put on your whole life, so you can once again step out as that innocent child you once were before you put on all that stuff society threw on you. And then it ends with, and we can talk about this in more depth, it ends with this incredible practice. Because once I finally, it took me so long to have the courage to stop racing. And then it took me another 4 years to have the courage to journey inward and face the darkness that was at kind of the center of my soul, that existential nothingness. And I find, and that to me was, there was inauthenticity on one side, there was authenticity on the other, and in between it was the abyss that I had to literally jump into, touch the bottom, which was that darkness, and then crawl barely up the other side into authenticity. And it took me 4 years to do that. And I almost didn't get out. It was that dark when I reached the bottom, but I did. And now I'm in the authentic living. But I realized that, unfortunately, authentic living, as I said, is not blissful every day. I thought it would be. And I had a real, like, come to whatever moment when I realized, wait a second, I still have low days and I did all this work. What the heck? 4 years of work. And I'm like, I can't be down again. But then I realized, nope, when you accept the full spectrum of who you are and you're a highly sensitive person like I am, who goes really high and really low, unfortunately, I'm going to have some low days. So what did that mean? It meant I and everyone on the planet, I believe, needs a deliberate daily practice, because I go too high when I'm creating. I go in this white, boundless space of imagination and I don't want to come down. And I could be up there for weeks, never eating, sleeping. I'm like so happy up there, but I want to be down here because I have a family and people who need me. And then I can go really low and be swallowed by the darkness and never come back up either. So the practice helps to keep me centered so that I can actually be here in my life, living every day.
When we come back, we'll ask you to walk us through the practice. And I have a few other questions, and Carrie does as well, about leadership. So stick around. This is going to be the fastest ad read you've ever seen. So don't run away. Literally don't run away. All right.
Literally.
Let's see. Here's two. Literally. Hey, you want your own domain? You can get one for a whole buck, 99 cents. cbrogan.me/online. You can get a .online domain for one whole dollar. Just use the code Chris in all caps at the checkout line, and they'll slip you some juicy, delicious things.
All caps.
Who writes these things? Hey, the other day I did a change to my search engine choice. And by the other day, I mean well over a month ago and counting. Presearch.com. You don't want to give all your secrets away to Google? Don't. Go to presearch.com. It's a whole different search engine written by a whole bunch of different nice people. It's kind of cool. It's tied to cryptocurrency as well. So you can hold some of these coins, and instead of paying for ads on this, and I'm pretty sure, you know, Melissa's had a lot of conversations in her organization about how to buy all the ads. You hold enough coins, you can stake out your claim on certain keywords. So toys could just say, well, I hold 1,000 of those coins. I guess I own toys. It's ridiculously inexpensive. Presearch.com.
And you can use it without logging in, though, if you're like, oh, if you don't even want to log in, you don't want to get the crypto, you just want a different search engine to use, you can try it. It's really good.
Presearch.com. So there you go. That's all my ad reads. All right. I'm grabbing Melissa back. Here we go. All right, Melissa, so our mutual friend Jonathan Fields, I guess, is credited with helping you find the word existential out and talking about Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. So that's interesting. There's sort of, I would assume, kind of a before that realization, before some of what you picked up, and there's after. Carrie had a leadership question, and I'm going to follow up with kind of a personal question as that relates.
Well, while you were talking, I was thinking about two things. One is that you're the head of this business and you lead all these people and set the tone for people's work habits and how they feel, you know, whether they feel appreciated and acknowledged in the workplace. But then you also are raising your own children. So how, while you're grappling with all of this internally, all this darkness, all this need to achieve, to feel like life has meaning, how do you raise your children, and how do you inspire others, you know, in a way that's going to be meaningful to them?
It's a great question. And I would say I didn't do a perfect job at either. You know, honestly, my mode was to be a complete robot and to serve everyone and everything and lead by example in my doing, because I continually did and served and didn't have any problem doing the grunt work, cleaning the floor. But I really wasn't that compassionate and empathetic to others, because I wasn't compassionate and empathetic to myself. So it's only in the last year when I finally offered myself compassion for being a human and imperfect and having a whole range of feelings that I was able to, I would say, show up to my own kids and show up to anyone I work with that same compassion. So it's really changed me. And I think I served well. You know, I checked every box off the list and I served physical needs as well as anyone. And I was there, I was present. And I was, you know, I was my full self, but my full self was only one emotion, which was, I'm great, I'm fine, everything's good. And I really hid everything else.
So eventually that's got to make its way out though, right?
It did. Yeah, it really did. I mean, eventually I knew I was living a lie and it felt horrible. And, you know, the truth was, I looked at these people who had these friendships since childhood and they would always get together with like their elementary school friends or their high school friends or their college friends. And I was like, I don't have any friends because all my friendships were one-sided my whole life. I basically was a sounding board for others' woes and kind of served them and never disclosed a thing about myself that was vulnerable because it meant like I was too stoic. I had to be perfect. And I realized that all relationships in my life were expendable because they were one-sided. So here I was, you know, my ripe old age, and I had never had like an authentic relationship or very few, you know, you could count them on a couple fingers. And I was desperate for those. Like I wanted real connections. I wanted to be honest with people, but I never learned how because from my childhood, I was told, don't show who you are. Don't be who you are, hide who you are and pretend you're perfect.
In the process of doing all this, there's kind of the before where you have some inklings of things aren't quite the way they should be. There's the, oh no, I just went down into the valley. I'm going to try to figure this out. Whoa, it was a lot harder than I thought it was. And then there's the other side of it where you say, maybe I can help some other people too.
Yeah.
You talked about a daily practice. Can you walk us through what we need to do for that? Or, I mean, presuming we're all
buying it. I absolutely can. So, you know, one of my own personal choices, I have no bias toward what anyone chooses in their lives, but I have chosen to go this road holistically because for me, my creativity is my salvation. And I was always so terrified about what something medicinal might do to my creativity that I couldn't even risk it. So I knew I was going at this holistically and I still needed my form of medicine because if I just wing it every day, it doesn't cut it. Once I decided to accept myself, I realized that I'm really oversensitive and I vacillate very dramatically and I can go into a dark place really quickly. So this practice has been something I've just developed. Actually, I'm honing it even as we speak in the last year because I've only just come out from my journey in accepting myself and realized that I can't just deny everything anymore. If I'm going to accept my full self, I need this practice. So metaphorically, it is a backpack that I strap on. I get up, I open my eyes each day. And before I even touch the floor with my feet, I grab my backpack. It's on my nightstand. It's pretend. And I strap it on. And it's my backpack of lifelines that are going to help me get through the day. And my new mantra is, practice makes purpose, because it's not practice makes perfect, because I'm not perfect. But for me, the practice gives my life meaning and purpose. It's that involved. So it's four areas that I've just really honed and I'm so excited about it. And I'm adding to it every day because it's a living, breathing, dynamic product. And I love product, as you know. So this will become a product in its own right. So you're hearing it as it's evolving. But actually the first section that I just added really yesterday, and it's all the letter E. So another byline is living life with ease. E apostrophe S, but it's also E-A-S-E because it's all E's. So the first E in the backpack is examination. And that means that I'm looking, and we all, and by the way, the letters, the words are the same for all of us. What we put in our backpack changes and is unique. So for anyone listening, like my, I would love create your own practice that it fits in your backpack because it's going to be different for all of us. So the examination, which comes out of the journey, is to start with all the limiting beliefs that make it so you don't engage in doing the work. And for me, I never believed in practice. I never believed I had time to do things. And it was sort of this sense that my examination of my limiting beliefs are basically, I'm not worth the time. I'm not worth indulgent behavior. Indulgent behavior is selfish. I'm too busy to do a selfish practice. It's a lot around time and that I'm going to be wasting time doing something that's not going to lead to a tangible goal, because that's all I'm about. And the practice isn't about tangible goals. So my limiting beliefs are all around that. So I have to know that before I start on these things, because I'm going to have to really deal with them. So then the first area is energy. And this for me was the hardest thing. Energy is, how do we fill our well every single day so it is brimming with life force, so we can serve and be our best selves and not become angry and bitter and bereft? So what does that mean? So energy for me is taking care of myself. And by the way, for those of you who became pleasers very early on, and pleasing was part of my validation, I became a martyr. I pleased without having my well full. My well was never full. We have to learn how to care for ourselves. And that's really hard. That's where all my negative beliefs come in. So it's, how do I nourish my body properly? Because I denied myself food for much of my life. How do I move my body properly without it becoming a goal-oriented exercise that becomes addictive? Because I have an addictive personality. And how do I rest my body in a way that's caring for it? Because sleep for me is a waste of time. And I would rather not sleep. And if I were not forcing myself to go to sleep when I'm tired, I would sleep maybe 2-3 hours a night, because I have too much to do. And my clock is ticking. So I have to create, because I don't have the internal compass to guide myself and take care of myself, I have to create external boundaries. So I have to say, Melissa, you need to sleep 7 hours a night. No matter what, you're going to bed at X time. And I have to force myself to do it. So that's energy. And I even changed the words, because it was initially, it was healthy eating, it was exercise, and it was sleep. And those, I didn't want to do any of them, because healthy eating meant there was good food and bad food. I couldn't do what my body wanted. You know, exercise became addictive, and sleep became something I didn't want to do. So I changed it to body nourishment, body movement, and body rest. And then the last one is body preventive care, because even things like going to the doctor, I never do, because I don't really care about that. So if I want to be here, though, for my 6 children and my companies and Doug, who I adore, like, I have to try to take care of myself. So that's really important. For some people, they take care of themselves. Like, it's not a big deal. For me, it's like the hardest thing. The second sort of compartment of my backpack is equanimity. And that's really cool. And it's a very interesting word. It has two parts of it. Equanimity is a dual-fold practice. The first part of equanimity, and basically equanimity, is grounding yourself so that you can be present for your life. But the first part of it is stopping and grounding yourself, which for those of us who race and engage in continual activity is much easier said than done. And I have a whole host of exercises I use that are in our journey that get us to stop. That's the S of the journey. It's stopping. And then the practice of equanimity is actually about becoming non-reactive to the triggers and emotions that rage through us each day. So the practice of equanimity is, how do I become a witness to all the emotions that flow through me? So if I'm having a really jealous day and I'm really jealous of someone, how can I not judge myself for that? How can I not berate myself and critique myself for that? How can I just look at it and say, wow, Melissa, you're really jealous of that person. What's going on there? Like, what's going on inside? Where's that wounded inner child who felt clearly jealous of a lot of people when she was little that's making this come up today? So it's learning how to remain impassive to all the emotions that come across us. So that's equanimity. That's also really hard for me. The first two are the hardest for me. The third one is essence. And that is beautiful. And essence is really throughout our entire lives asking the question, who am I? Why am I here? And what are those innate sparks in me, those sparks of self-expression that long to ignite and create a bonfire sort of with humanity? Because we all long to take something within us and connect it to others. And that's where the circle comes around and where we find our meaning. But most of us have no idea what our essence is. We become so guided by society and our parents and what others tell us to do that we never learn to really hear the cry of our own soul. So it involves from early on asking the questions like, when am I the happiest? When does time stop? What are the things I do when my heart sings? You know, what do I want to spend my days doing? What would I do if I weren't, there was no money or no one looking over my shoulder? And it's really every day and it changes. You know, our essence of what we want to bring forth and manifest continually changes as we evolve. So I think we have to always ask ourselves those questions. And we have a lot of exercises to find that. And then the last compartment is engagement. And engagement is really important too. And we found that during COVID, how important it is. Engaging our sparks is one part of it. And we can have play sparks. Our play sparks are just the things we do for fun. And we saw during COVID, I talked with so many people who had fallen into despair because they stopped playing. They stopped doing the things that brought them joy. They stopped going outside. They stopped playing music. They stopped drinking tea. That's one of my, I drink it all the time. They stopped really because they were so despondent over COVID and what it did to their lives. They forgot that they still needed to keep that inner child alive. So play sparks are something we have to do every single day to feel that joie de vivre, you know, that love of life. And then meaning sparks are the more important essence sparks that we need to bring out and create the meaning. And that involves more connecting it to others. And then the second half of it is engaging with people, engaging with others in authentic relationships. And that's another one that's really hard for me because I'm an introvert and my natural tendency is to remove myself from people. If I don't force myself to engage with others, I will tend to just like quietly slip away. And we know that we are all biological. Whether it seems like we should be with people or not, we have to be. And by definition, if we are removed from people, we will fall into isolation and despair ultimately. And isolation leads directly to depression. So it becomes a deliberate practice. I know during COVID, I would say to people, make a phone call every night to someone you love and make it a pattern every single day. And they were like, I can't. You have to. Like, talk to someone, because if you don't, you'll feel yourself starting to get smaller and smaller. And you'll feel like almost you are, you know, shrinking. And that's not a good thing. So that's my practice. And I engage in it every single day.
Can we talk about jealousy for a second? You mentioned it and then sort of went on to the next thing, but jealousy is so powerful and can actually be a really useful compass to figure out where things are maybe lacking in your life.
And how nobody talks about it. That it's one of those things that was maybe competition and jealousy have been the two things that have probably been the biggest scourges in my life. Because as a child, my biggest mantra was, it's not fair. You know, I always felt, again, I felt a victim. I felt that everyone had it better than I. And I was so angry and jealous of anyone that had anything that I didn't have, because I felt so alone in my soul. And I think I never really came to terms with that. And the only reason I did is because I started being triggered as an adult by adults in my life. I would suddenly be like, what is going on? What is this feeling in me? And I was like, I'm jealous. And I would, my first thought was, Melissa, you can't be jealous. Like, I would get so angry at myself for being jealous, and I would berate myself like, you have everything. Why are you jealous of her? That's what my voice would say. And it wasn't until I had the courage to say, stop berating yourself. You're jealous. Like, let's trace it back. And what I realized when I, you know, and everything gets traced back to the wounded inner child who basically suffered a trauma. And a trauma could be something as simple as someone saying, you know, you're no good, you're dumb. You know, my uncle used to call me TB, two bellies, when I was young, because I was chubby. That set up my whole life for eating disorders. You know, those, him calling me that one thing. So a trauma doesn't have to be some, like, you were left abandoned on a street. A trauma is anything that wasn't processed properly and became a wound that you held onto and triggered a certain behavior your whole life. So when I traced that jealousy, which I feel still quite often, whenever I trace it back to the wounded inner child, it's always that child that was like, it's not fair. And when I look at it, it's never something I want that the person has. It's anything that I don't have, whether it's something I want or not. So when I look at it rationally, I'm like, I don't even want what she has, but it's something I don't have. So my automatic, like, behavior pattern is to be jealous of it. So, wow. But when I go back and I go back to that wounded inner child and I realize, okay, it's not my friend, because it feels ugly to be jealous of a friend. But when I see, it's not my friend, it's me. It's that wounded inner child that never was told, you're good enough as you are. You don't need to look at what he or she or they have. Like, you are enough. And I go back to that child and I give her, you know, I do this thing, and it's known, called a butterfly hug, where you give yourself, like, you reparent from the inside out. You know, I have to go back, and at my age, I have to give that wounded child a butterfly hug and say, I get it. You're okay. I'm sorry. You know, and usually I'll just say, I'm so sorry. Once I do that, once I allow that inner child to be embraced as she is, usually those feelings go away and I'm not jealous anymore. I actually just gave myself the love I needed. So that's something I think we all need to do many times each day. And that's part of my daily practice of equanimity.
Perfect. Well, we've come to the last two parts of the show, although one of them is going to be kind of funny tonight, but I'll do this one.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
I think Leslie brought it in, person of the day, at the very end. Leslie said that, I recently had a young student ask me how old you were going to be when you could get to happily ever after. It was an incredible question for a kid's age. Told them that it was always going to be a work in progress. I thought that was a good one. Leslie, you're now person of the day. Now you get an apple. You just have to go and buy it yourself.
And wash it really good.
Wash it really good. Carrie always reminds us. Now, every guest we've ever had on the show, we ask the same question, which is, what goes in your backpack? But we just got a very detailed reading of what goes in your backpack.
You did.
Aha! I already answered it.
Well, Leslie, other people will be like, kindness, extra set of teeth. My cell phone. Like, it's your 17. There's very only one other person had, like, a framework, and at that time we were not prepared for it. So this is a whole other different scenario.
Yeah, what's going in mine is examination, energy, equanimity, essence, and engagement, baby. My lifelines.
You did it. Well, people Perfect. Know where to find you, because we put the link up about 8,000 times. We have no other questions. The one thing I was just going to say to you, though, is that in watching this and observing this and sort of thinking through all the various experiences that you've gone through, reminds me of advice that my grandmother gave me around, you know, what you put on your plate, what you choose to eat, and how to kind of make that all line up. And she always said...